Mr. Elliott, good morning to you. You may approach. Ms. Osborne, also good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
I do not.
Then, Mr. Elliott, you may proceed.
Thank you. Sean Elliott with the Public Defender's Office here in Lancaster County. I am representing Mr. Brennauer. Mr. Brennauer had a jury trial here in Lancaster County. The trial was in 2021, sentenced in July, and was sentenced to a total of 57 to 79 years on four counts: possession of deadly weapon, second-degree assault on an officer, attempted first-degree assault on another officer, and then use of a deadly weapon. And the errors that are assigned, I'd like to start with Mr. Brennauer's first assigned error, which is that the district court should have suppressed statements that were made. There's two different sets of statements. There are sets of statements from the residence that he was located at where the incident took place here in Lincoln, Nebraska. And those statements, I'm gleaning through the record in the brief, I think can be summarized as follows. He said he had done nothing wrong. I'm not going nowhere. He did not want the officers there, wanted officers to leave. He claimed he did not have a knife. He had used a knife earlier while cooking. He had taken his medication. He wanted to keep a book or a Bible that he had in his hands. And then right prior to the actual incident, he had wanted to shake the hands with Officer Atkinson. So I think those are the statements that were at issue in terms of the first portion of the motion to suppress. Now, it was the defense's argument at the motion to suppress, as well as then the renewing of that motion and objection to the statements, that those statements were all made in a custodial setting.
Were they interrogation?
Well, that's the question. Now, the lower court, the district court judge, she determined that Miranda was not required because it was only an investigatory detention. That's what her ruling was, and she said it never was transferred to a de facto arrest. Obviously, I think there's a give and take between the officer or officers and Mr. Brennauer. They are essentially wanting him to produce a knife or show he doesn't have a knife. Ultimately, there's a decision he's going to be put into emergency protective custody.
So no crime has been even committed at this point.
Well, you know, the thing is, there might be potentially some crime because I believe Ms. Perez, who was his girlfriend, had a cut to her hand, is my recollection. There were statements made by a gentleman named Marti, as well as Ms. Perez, that he was unstable, had threatened suicide, put a knife to his own neck, and was in a fairly deranged state at that point in time. So I don't think they had made that determination, Judge, but there was no communication really between Officer Wiorda, W-I-E-R-D-A, I'm not sure that's how you say his name. He had made a decision he was going to EPC him, but there were such a number of officers that I'm not sure that was conveyed necessarily to the other officer, Officer Atkinson in particular, who then went to grab Mr. Brennauer where the incident unfolded. But either way, I mean, he was obviously being taken to custody, whether it's an EPC or an arrest, but I think it's clear it was really for an EPC at that point in time. So
if it's an EPC, isn't it hard to argue that was interrogation? I mean, wasn't the goal of the officers to bring him in, not to question him for a crime?
Well, and I think that might somewhat relate to the state's argument on appeal that perhaps this is a public safety exception.
Well, maybe public safety, or maybe just, I mean, Miranda requires both that the suspect be in custody and that the statements be the result of interrogation. You'd agree with that, right?
Yes.
So how can you show that this was interrogation?
Well, I think any time you're dealing with a law enforcement officer, you are essentially being required to engage with them.
Do you have any authority for that?
Well, in a traffic stop, I mean, you just can't simply not roll the window down and just sit there. I mean, you're leading to other things.
Engaging can mean a lot of things. Are you required to have a conversation with an officer? Are you required? I mean, they ask for identification. Probably have to give them the identification, but do you have to have a conversation?
Well, I guess if your question is this really truly interrogation, that's the issue I guess the court has.
Has any court ever found that officers trying to de-escalate a scene were actually engaged in interrogation?
I'm not aware of that. I didn't see that in the brief.
Wouldn't it be a little bit contrary to the whole concept of de-escalating and bringing somebody into EPC to give a Miranda warning at the beginning of it?
No, I think you're right. I think that by its very nature, there's going to be some back and forth because you're trying to ascertain whether the person is coherent, suicidal, what's going on with the person. But, and in all honesty, those statements are probably less significant than maybe the statements at the hospital were, quite frankly.
So were there any interrogations at the hospital?
Well, in the hospital statements, three officers testified. Officer Spilker had said that she had heard him say, quote, "I never should have stabbed a cop. He thought they would tase him, but he did not think they would shoot him."
Was that in response to a question?
It was not.
So, not interrogation.
Well, the argument that Mr. Brennauer made, which is essentially that, obviously he was arrested on December 29th. He was taken to the hospital.
He was in custody.
Yeah, he was clearly in custody because he was, he was being guarded essentially at the hospital room. He was restrained, clearly in custody. And Mr. Brennauer's argument essentially is that it's the persistence of the officers being in or near the room, notepad in hand, hoping that he might say something. That's essentially the argument is that it's a functional equivalent of questioning.
I realize all of these suppression issues are hugely, actually significant. But do you have any case law or any authority that kind of sort of police hovering, if you will, results in the equivalent of interrogation?
Well, I don't have any specific authority. It's not case or facts specific anyways. The case that the district court relied on was Arizona versus Morrow, M-A-U-R-O. And in that case, there was no questioning because the suspect was allowed to talk to his wife. The officers permitted that. And lo and behold, he made some incriminating statements. The court said that that's not really questioning because just hoping that he might say something that incriminates him doesn't make it interrogation. This is a little bit different. It's a little more involved, in my opinion, because this is a fair, obviously police officers were injured. There was what the police perceived to be a threat to their safety, wearing the same uniforms that were in the house that day on December 29th, guarding him outside the room. Every time he moved around the room, he had to have an officer there to loosen the restraints, to make sure, obviously, that something was going to happen. So even when he dealt with medical staff, the police were involved in that.
Do we have cases where the defendant was hospitalized?
I'm sure there probably are, but I did not see any of the brief. When I looked at it myself, I didn't find any cases that would be specific to the unusual situation. Because, in most crimes, you don't have someone go to the hospital and you're there for 10 days or whatever. You're not being guarded at the door. Those things happen in movies, but they rarely happen in real life. But I did not find any cases on that. So
before your time completely expires, did you want to discuss the prior conviction of not guilty by reason of insanity or the expert opinion regarding the proof of?
Yeah, and I would say, I think it's clear that everyone knew that that was going on, that that had occurred, whether there was specific evidence of the, certainly the a certified copy of that finding was not put into evidence. But in the state's own motion, they knew it. That's why they filed a motion limine. And in fact, that insanity case was at times heard the same time as this criminal case. And that the verdict was entered and he was sentenced, they brought up the insanity finding and he was then taken out of LRC and committed to Department of Corrections. So I don't think it's, I know there was no offer of proof. Probably the best practice is you should offer, do an offer of proof. But I think it was certainly substantial to the fact he had a defense, wanted to raise that. It would show the depth of his problem.
Of course, how much of the depth of his problem came in anyway with, for example, the testimony of the experts?
Yeah, there was certainly testimony about his background. I mean, he had been a long-standing mental, had long-standing mental health issues, long-standing mental health diagnosis, long-standing need for treatment at the regional center.
And the jury heard all that?
Well, they heard most of it. Obviously, they did not hear the case from 2003. But I think in terms of the confrontation issue, I think what they were trying to say, Mr. Brennard's defense, was that they could have then cross-examined Dr. Simple on that, and it would have also bolstered Dr. Arias's opinion.
And the court sustained the motion limine on relevance, or was that the basis?
Yeah, I believe that's correct, Judge, yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Before you sit down,
okay.
I want to ask you a question about burdens of proof on the not responsible by reason of insanity and the relatively new statutory addition by the legislature in regard to intoxication.
Right.
Who should have the burden of proof on the issue of whether or not someone was under the influence?
You know, that's a very...
And what should that stand? What burden of proof should that be?
The burden is on the defendant, at least in terms of show greater weight that he was, in fact, met the criteria. But in the statute, I think the last section of the insanity statute says unless there is caused by ingestion of drugs or whatever. I believe at that point it should be the burden of the state to establish that beyond a reasonable doubt that in fact there was the presence of a hallucinating drug or a street drug or whatever it might be that would trigger that psychotic episode. So I think that
how is that handled in this case?
I don't think it was. There's a step instruction, and the step instruction requires that the jury look at the insanity did the state or the defense established by greater weight of the evidence that in fact he met that criteria. If so, then you got to find him not responsible for reason of insanity. Otherwise, you got to find him guilty because they have gone through the steps. I mean, this was not about was a crime committed because it met the elements. But I don't believe it was addressed. And, you know, I think both experts, I don't think Dr. Arias believed that there was any significant being under the influence of drugs or narcotics that triggered it. And I don't even believe that Dr. Simple did either. I think she believed that it was due to his lack of memory was not due to intoxication, but rather repressed a traumatic event and had repressed the memory. They obviously disagreed as to whether he met the criteria, but I'm not sure the presence of alcohol or drugs that were used by either expert felt that that was sufficient that would trigger this psychotic episode. So but I do believe it should be on the burden, it should be on the state to establish that there was something that deprives him of the right to present that defense. So thank you.
There are no assignments of instructional error.
No, there are not.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Osborne, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good
May it please the court, my name is Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General representing the Appalachian, the state of Nebraska. In this case, police encountered an armed standoff situation where the appellant possessed a knife that he would not relinquish. When police tried to take appellant into custody, there was a struggle during which he attempted to stab one officer, and he was successful in stabbing another officer. After a jury trial where insanity was advanced as a defense, appellant was found guilty of the four charges related to that stabbing incident. So I'll begin with the statements. Appellant argues that his statements at the scene and at the hospital were obtained in violation of Miranda because he was never read his Miranda warnings prior to making those statements. The state disagrees that there was any Miranda violation because appellant was not subject to custodial interrogation. Here, Officer Atkinson attempted to take appellant into emergency protective custody when he offered to shake his hand just prior to the struggle, and thereafter appellant didn't make any statements. So what we're looking at is what happened before he offered to shake the appellant's hand. Here the district court made several factual findings that were supported by the record and not clearly erroneous. Shortly after being invited into the residence by another occupant, the two of the officers observed appellant holding a knife. In response, multiple officers drew tasers, one officer drew his firearm, all of which were pointed at the ground. The officers attempted to get the appellant to relinquish that knife, which is when the appellant made the relevant statements, which were discussed earlier, generally basically just denying having a knife and wanting the officers to leave. The officers were told by other individuals who were present that appellant had a knife before the officers arrived, and that the appellant had held that knife up to his own throat. Another person in the residence had also been cut on the hand by the appellant. Federal appellate courts have held that when officers are presented with serious danger in the course of carrying out an investigative detention, they may brandish weapons or even constrain the suspect in handcuffs in order to control the scene and protect their safety. That does not amount to a de facto arrest. Here, the officers had their weapons drawn, pointed at the ground in reasonable response to a safety threat posed when the officers observed the appellant holding a knife. They were concerned about getting the appellant to relinquish the knife or ascertaining where the knife went because he had hidden it at that point. And that was in an effort to provide for everyone's safety, including the other two individuals who were in the residence. Any conversation that went between the officers and the appellant was in furtherance of that safety concern and not for the purpose of obtaining incriminating statements. And I think as Justice Stacy pointed out earlier, it would just simply be imprudent to say that while officers are trying to disarm an individual who's holding a weapon that he could use to harm himself or harm others, that the officers need to be shouting Miranda warnings at him. That would be contrary to the purpose of their function in trying to maintain the safety and de-escalate the situation. So for those reasons, the state's position is that there was no custody, there was no interrogation. There are several courts that have held in similar situations that there was no custody or interrogation for purposes of Miranda. Even if we did assume, just for the sake of argument, that appellant was somehow subject to custodial interrogation while the officers were trying to de-escalate the situation, there's still no error in admitting the statements because of the public safety exception from New York versus Quarles. That public safety exception recognizes that officers should not be penalized for asking the very safety questions that are the most crucial to their efforts to protect themselves and the public. In this situation at the residence, there was no Miranda violation related to appellant statements because there was no custody, no interrogation, or the public safety exception applies. So moving then, if there are no questions about the statements at the scene. Moving to the statements at the hospital, appellant was clearly in custody. That's not at issue. The state maintains that, again, there's no interrogation. The statements that were made were spontaneous comments, so Miranda does not apply. There clearly was no express questioning. The officers that were there had nothing to do with the investigation. They just were officers that were employed by the Lincoln Police Department. They didn't know anything about the case. They just had been assigned.
What were they instructed to do in regard to statements made by the defendant?
I believe they were just instructed to document if something happened, if something was said. I think they were just I don't know if they were specifically instructed. I think some of the witnesses testified that's just their normal course. I just defer the record specifically on what was said there.
Appellant points out that they wrote down apparently what the defendant said, but they didn't write down witnesses or any of the circumstances. Does that make any difference?
I don't believe that it does, at least for purposes of interrogation. The officers themselves did not ask any questions at all, so there's no express questioning whatsoever. So then we go to the functional equivalent. Is that something that existed? And with one exception, none of the officers even spoke to the defendant whatsoever. The one exception is that one of, in response to the appellant asking her a question, she said, "I'm not going to talk to you." That's the only thing that any of the officers said the entire time they were there. So that's not the functional equivalent. They just were simply either seated in a chair at the door or standing right inside the door, or at one point he wanted to be moved from the bed, so she had to undo his handcuffs to move him to the chair. They didn't interact with him at all, so there's no functional equivalent of questioning. Everything he said was spontaneous, volunteered statements, not subject to Miranda warnings. And I did note in the brief, arguably, the statements at the hospital are waived because of State versus Serber. This court has recently held that the introduction of evidence by the defense waives any objection to the earlier introduction of the same evidence by the state. In their affirmative insanity defense, Dr. Arias testified specifically to the statements that were made at the hospital, so it's presented in their case. And at that point, they've waived any previous admission.
Has this court written about the hospital circumstance?
There are Nebraska cases about statements in hospitals. Those cases involve questioning. Those cases involve an investigator coming in and asking questions of someone who is being treated at the hospital. Here, that's not at all what happened. No questions were asked. Virtually no statements whatsoever were made. They simply were just standing at the door, making sure that he remained in custody.
Is it like listening into a jail call?
Yeah, I guess that could be. It's not dissimilar from the Arizona Morrill case that was referenced earlier. It's just an officer standing there, happens to hear something that the defendant blurts out, and they wrote it down. So there is no interrogation involved. Voluntariness, it's difficult to tell if this is even being brought up as part of their assigned errors. It's not argued in the brief. There's a couple propositions of law that are stated in appellant's brief, but this issue is not actually argued, so I don't actually believe that voluntariness is before the court. I don't think the court needs to address it. It hasn't been properly raised. But even if it were, there's no evidence that any of the officers, either at the scene or at the hospital, elicited statements through threats, coercion, inducements of leniency, and course of police activity is a necessary predicate for finding that a confession is not voluntary. As for the mental illness issue, it's just a factor in the totality of the circumstances, and there's no per se rule that invalidates the voluntariness of someone who is mentally ill, of a statement made by someone who's mentally ill. So, and the district court made factual findings related to that, that he understood what he was saying, he was responsive, he was coherent in his comments, so voluntariness is not really an issue here. Unless there are...
Before you sit down, I want to ask you two about burdens of proof in this situation. Same question I asked Mr. Elliott about whose burden it is to show, for example, temporary intoxication, and how was that handled in this case?
It's the defendant's burden to prove by preponderance of the evidence that the defense is not responsible by reason of insanity. So just overall, they have the defendant's burden to show that. The temporary condition, the statute doesn't say whose burden that is specifically. In this case, I don't know that is a primary concern here because, yes, in use of substances is involved in some of the testimony.
Let's assume it should have been a primary concern. What should have happened here? What instructions were given to the jury?
Oh, the instructions themselves, I would have to defer to the record. I don't recall specifically what instruction was given or if any was given specifically to an intoxication issue. But in this case, the statute just indicates that insanity does not include a temporary condition that was proximately caused by voluntary ingestion of substances. So typically that would be the state presenting that type of evidence.
So should the state have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, I think the state would have to demonstrate that exists and that would refute the defendant's preponderance of the evidence standard or burden.
So again, should that be beyond a reasonable doubt?
I don't know that would be the standard beyond a reasonable doubt. I think the state would just have to present evidence indicating that voluntary intoxication was involved and that the existence of that voluntary intoxication refutes the defense, the affirmative defense, such that they cannot show by a preponderance of the evidence their affirmative defense.
Are you saying that the state's burden should be preponderance of the evidence?
I honestly don't know if I can answer that question. I don't know what the burden of proof would be on that. It's not in the statute. I don't know that there's any. I'm not familiar if there's a specific case on that. But in this case, I don't know that it matters here because while ingestion of substances was part of some of the discussion from both experts. It was considered by both experts to be his ingestion of substances exacerbated his psychiatric issues. But that is not the ultimate opinion by either expert that the use of substances in and of themselves caused the condition.
Did the state argue that insanity wasn't available because of temporary intoxication?
There may have been an argument by original trial counsel to that effect, but that ultimately the opinion by the state's expert was just simply this defendant does not qualify for the insanity defense, not because of a voluntary intoxication issue, but because they understood the difference between right and wrong, because they didn't meet the second prong of the Monotin test. So Ultimately, the state's expert didn't rely on this voluntary intoxication subsection as the reason why he was not legally insane. That opinion stands regardless of this final subsection. He was not legally insane because he understood the difference between right and wrong. He understood the consequences of his actions.
But it was an instruction given, essentially quoting the statute in regard to intoxication.
It may have been. There are no assignments of error on the instructions, so I haven't reviewed closely, specifically for purposes of this oral argument or for the briefing, what were in the instructions. I know that the issue of intoxication and voluntary intoxication is something that was discussed. It is part of the record. But the ultimate opinion of the state's expert doesn't rely on that as the reason why he was not legally insane, if that makes sense. So I apologize. I don't know that I can provide you an answer because I don't know that that's been stated as of yet.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
We have no time for rebuttal. Counsel, that concludes arguments in State versus Brennauer. You are excused. The next case of the day is In Re Interest of Elijah King F.